and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Federal Coordinator of Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects Larry Persily, World Trade Center Anchorage Executive Director Greg Wolf, and Northern Economics President and Senior Economist Marcus Hartley deliver the 2015 Statewide Economic Forecast at a luncheon hosted by the World Trade Center Anchorage. This talk was recorded on January 27th at the Hilton Anchorage and has been shortened for broadcast. Greg Wolf provided an introduction for guest Larry Persily.
Arguably, one of the most important and talked about topics in Alaska is whether or not a pipeline will be built to move North Slope gas to markets, and if so, when. One of the projects, the Alaska LNG project, with a projected cost of somewhere between $45 and $65 billion, would represent the single largest investment ever made in the state. It would also be the single largest export project in the state. That's why we're keenly interested in this. That being the case, we thought it would be very timely to have Larry Persily, someone who knows a lot about this subject, to talk with us today about the prospects for development of an Alaska gas pipeline project. He'll talk about a number of important issues surrounding the subject, including the competitive environment and other market conditions that will impact decision making. As I mentioned, Larry is the federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. Before accepting this presidential appointment in 2010, he worked for more than a decade on Alaska's oil and gas issues for three governors and the state legislature. He started at the Department of Revenue in 97. He served as deputy commissioner from 99 to 2003. Later, he worked on the governor's Washington D.C. office on oil and tax matters. He served as a legislative aide in 2009, 2010, working on federal economic stimulus funding, oil and gas issues, and natural gas storage legislation. Before joining the government, personally worked as a journalist for more than 20 years. He also worked as an investigator for the state's ombudsman office, as a budget and tax aide for the municipality of Anchorage, and as a writer and editor on several fiscal policy and oil gas research projects in the state. Please join me in welcoming Larry Persily.
I'll say as I get older and listen to the introductions when I speak, I realize how much I am getting older because how much the resume is getting longer. I was going to talk to you about prospects for the Alaska LNG project, but before that, just a brief history lesson for people who know me. I tend to fixate on history because I can't accept reality and I don't accept change. I still have a flip-top phone held together by scotch tape, which tells you how well I deal with change. So, 56 years ago tomorrow, the first liquefied natural gas moved aboard a tanker. First LNG shipment ever in the world. And the history behind that was 10 years before the first tanker load ever left Nikiski from the plant there in 1969. So the brief history on this is in the 1950s, Union Stockyard and Transit, by the name you can assume they were a slaughterhouse in Chicago, Union Stockyard and Transit and Continental Oil, which later became Conoco. In the 50s, these two companies were experimenting with how to get natural gas from the Gulf Coast, freeze it, turn it into a liquid, and bring it up to Chicago for the stockyard. About the same time, later in the 50s, the United Kingdom and Japan also were looking at how they could import LNG, that their countries were running short of natural gas. So these guys, men and women with Union Stockyards and Conoco, took a World War II Liberty ship, one of the old freighters, got it at surplus in the 50s, built storage tanks inside the hold using aluminum and balsa wood. At the dock in Lake Charles, Louisiana, they filled it with 32,000 gallons of LNG and set it sail for the United Kingdom with it, arriving near London 3 weeks later, thankfully, safely. To give you an idea, 32,000 gallons of LNG is about the equivalent of 1% of the natural gas that South Central burns on an average day. It was a small test project, worked out very well, and worked out well for Alaska. So, in terms of where we are today, whether this project gets built, whether we get into a big scale export project. You know, as you look at the markets, it doesn't look easy today. Three new LNG export production projects came online just in the last year alone, serving the Pacific Rim. At the same time those new supplies were coming online, demand was weakening. Demand wasn't slipping in Asia, but it was weaker than the optimistic growth projections. So more supply, less demand, prices are dropping for LNG in Asia. Also, liquefied natural gas in Asia is priced essentially on the equivalency of oil. You're going to burn fuel oil, you're going to burn natural gas to generate electricity. It's just BTUs turned into kilowatt hours. So as oil prices are dropping, so are LNG prices. About a year ago, $20 per million BTU was the spot price in Asia. Now it's under half that, $9. Most expect that that oversupply market will continue this decade, but by the 2020s and beyond, there will be a supply shortage again, and that's our opportunity. This project is not for this decade. This project is for the decades and beyond. But just double back a minute. In Australia, they opened up. They're building six new LNG export projects in Australia, about $200 billion worth. First one opened up in December with its first cargoes. The others will come on in the next couple years. Good thing is most of the capacity from those plants has already been sold under long-term contracts. So again, Alaska's looking at the market 2020s and beyond. So like I say, it's the long term, not what's going on today. Alaskans have long been fixated on the daily oil price. That's what drives how much money we have in the state treasury to spend for capital projects and everything else. It really doesn't matter for this project. It doesn't matter for liquefied natural gas, which is sold on long-term contracts. And the issue is going to be what's going to happen in the 2020s and beyond. There will be a lot of projects built. Can we be competitive enough to get into that market? I will say one thing. Alaskans, as they think about the state's take, that quote-unquote fair share of the resource, what we're going to get because we're the owner state out of this, you know, Alaskans should not expect this project to solve all their fiscal problems. There just isn't that much profit in natural gas compared to 2 million barrels a day of oil we used to have in 1988. So on a personal note, you're still going to have to look at taxes, and you're still going to have to look at the permanent fund, and you just got to get used to it. But aside from my personal view, I will move back to the presentation. Hey, you know, when you got 5 weeks left in your job, who cares what you say? They can't fire me. They don't pay moving when the job ends, so they got nothing on me. In fact, someone today with the Federal of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, because we're going through a shutdown, we weren't funded, she said, well, it was an accounting issue. She said, I think you're in violation of the Deficiencies Act. To which I said, I don't know what it is and I don't care. She said she'd get back to me. So, Federal Energy, by then the phone will be disconnected. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission goes by the acronym FERC. Many of us know it well. You need FERC approval to build and operate an LNG plant in this country, period. They're the ones who tell you, is it safe? What about environmental effects? The project sponsors, Alaska LNG, Exxon, BP, Conoco, TransCanada, State of Alaska, have told FERC they will start submitting the draft environmental resource reports next month. That will trigger a notice in the Federal Register from FERC under the National Environmental Policy Act. There's a contractor on board to help draft the environmental impact statement. FERC will be holding scoping sessions around the state later this year, and that's where they go into the communities and say, what issues do you want addressed in the EIS? What should be covered in here so we don't leave it out? What are your concerns about the project? In addition to that FERC authorization to build and operate this, the other big federal approval you need is Department of Energy authorization to export the molecules overseas. Anyone who has dealt with the export license for the Conoco plant in Nikiski over the years knows this well. The Department of Energy is well versed in it. They have granted export authorization to the Nikiski plant 11 times since 1969. Some more contentious than others, but they've always come through. The Department of Energy in December granted approval to this project to export to free trade nations. Not an issue, not controversial, automatic. It's the non-free trade status: Japan, China, India, Thailand, Vietnam. Those are the ones that you really need. They went out for public comments. There was only one statement of opposition. Well, there was one from Fairbanks, but he somehow equated this project with the Fairbanks borough, with Russia, with a declaration of war. So we can dismiss that one. There was one statement of opposition. It came from the Sierra Club. They are objecting to LNG exports all over the country. So I would expect sometime this year free trade, non-free trade export approval will be granted to this project. The Energy Secretary, in a letter in October to Senator Begich, said they would move as quickly as possible on this project, and they have been doing that. One thing real quickly, it's different for Alaska. There are more than two dozen proposed LNG export projects lined up at the Department of Energy waiting for approval. The Department of Energy has those on one list. The Alaska LNG project is on its own list on a different procedure. All the others have to wait for their EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement, and FERC review to be completed before the Department of Energy will grant export approval. Alaska is not covered by those policies. The Department of Energy will decide on the Alaska export application separate from the EIS and from FERC. They won't wait for that, which is great, because once you get this export authorization, it's a good signal to the market that you have legal authority to sell. You still got to go through the EIS, but you don't have to wait 3 years for it to be completed. Make or break, so turning to the economics, you know, it's just going to come down to supply and demand. Does China continue strong economic growth? Does China decide that buying more natural gas is better than polluting their own air and hurting their own people with coal? How many nuclear plants does Japan start? How strong is the economic growth in Latin America and Brazil? How much does the Middle East turn away from burning fuel oil to burning natural gas for power generation? Indonesia is a long-time LNG exporter, but because of declining production and increasing local demand, Indonesia is cutting its LNG exports this year 25%. Egypt, which has only been exporting LNG for about a decade, is pretty much shutting it down, and they are buying LNG. They will be importing cargo. So it's really going to come down to what happens in the world economy. China, the big player. Japan right now is the world's largest LNG importer. Most expect China will pass Japan by the end of the decade. China used to be self-sufficient in gas production until about 7 or 8 years ago. They now import about 30% of their natural gas, about half by LNG and half by pipeline from Central Asia, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Myanmar, used to be Burma. So China has options. So global demand, supply, how many other new projects get built, and what other energy sources, such as China buying pipeline gas. Like I say, it's just going to come down to risk and price. No one is going to pay a premium for Alaska gas. It's not like Copper River salmon. They don't care. It's so many million BTUs per so many thousand cubic feet. Dependability counts, credibility counts, stability counts, but price really counts. Because in the end, the power generator, the gas utilities, just got to pass it through to customers, no different than Detroit Edison or, NSTAR or anyone else. Price is going to be essential. That comes down to engineering the project down to the lowest cost you can, reducing risks. And as I looked around the world the last couple of years, I have not found an LNG project, despite the huge upfront costs. I've not found one that's ever lost money, but I've found ones that, because of cost overruns, supply problems, are not making what they thought they were going to make when they put $20, $30 billion into it. Instead of double-digit returns, they're going to make single-digit returns, and that's a tough one to explain to management after you convince them to write the checks. So what are the odds for Alaska? I'm not going to give you odds. I am in my 60s. I am in fixed income. I don't do equities anymore. But I'd say, honestly, it is the best it's been in 40 years. Not because we necessarily did anything. It's just the market has grown. LNG, natural gas, is increasingly a fuel of choice. Emerging nations, particularly on the Pacific Rim, demand is growing. And fortunately, two things. It's we need the money. We'd like to turn that gas into cash. We've been reinjecting it. It's forced out more oil. We've been using it. Producers have been using it. No matter critics who say they've been warehousing the gas, Prudhoe Bay initially was supposed to produce 9 billion barrels. It's now produced 12 billion. They expect it to get up to 14 billion. A lot of that is because they're using the gas to reinject for the reservoir pressure. But it's coming time where you could take some of that gas off, sell it, and not appreciably kill off your oil recovery. Just quickly to run through some of the competition, the world has no shortage of gas. Everybody has it. The question is who's going to get into the market with new projects. There are 18 proposed LNG projects on the west coast of Canada alone, another 4 or 5 on the eastern coast, Nova Scotia. Someone actually even proposed one the other day in Quebec on the St. Lawrence Seaway. None of them have gone to final investment decision. The reason is, just like Alaska, they are expensive and they have problems. If they were easy, someone would have made the investment decision long ago. Petronas, Malaysia's oil and gas company, is considered the leader among potentials in British Columbia. They want to build a plant near Prince Rupert. They were supposed to make their investment decision in December. In December, they announced, got to get the cost down, can't do it. We're going to work with suppliers, we're going to work with engineers, we're going to keep working on trying to get the cost down, no investment decision. Many of them are in that same boat. Other problems in Canada, the gas fields are in extreme northeast BC, that's 300, 400, 500 miles of pipeline, not as long as Alaska, because of course Alaska has the biggest of everything, but it's still a very long, expensive pipeline. First Nations issues, the Aboriginal First Nations want their voices heard on these projects. And they have salmon habitat issues off the coast of British Columbia. U.S. Gulf Coast, there are 4 LNG export projects under development in the United States right now. 3 on the Gulf Coast and 1 on Chesapeake Bay. They are all formerly LNG import terminals that were not having any business because no one was importing LNG because we have all the shale gas we need. So the owners said, well, I got storage tanks, I got pipes, I got docks. For $6 billion more, I can put in a liquefaction plant, at least make some money. So these are what they refer to as brownfield. The first one should start shipping gas by the end of this year. The next 3, next few years will come online. There are 24 other proposals out there waiting for permits, export authorization, investment decision. I doubt more than a few more will get built. A lot of them are just speculation. They are certainly competition, though I think when they get built and they actually go into business, you'll see a lot of that gas stay in the Atlantic Basin. It's expensive to move LNG from the Gulf Coast through the Panama Canal, which is being expanded and widened and deepened. It's still going to be an expensive run, still going to be a long voyage. And if you can get about the same price minus transportation, you'll just sell it in South America or Europe. There's nothing that says all that gas has to come to Asia, though that's certainly what everyone's talking about. Russia's an interesting one. That's the last competitor I was going to talk about in the Pacific Rim. Russia has 1 LNG plant, Sakhalin Island. There is a second under development on the Yamal Peninsula, extreme northern Arctic Russia. Yamal is about halfway between Iceland and Nome. Nothing against either one. It's pretty much up there in the middle of nowhere. It's a very expensive project, $27 billion. They are running into financing problems because of Western sanctions. Western banks won't loan them money. They're talking to China. They're not going to get a bargain rate for it. The government is helping out. The Russian government is building the port, the airports, and the icebreakers. And because financing is tight because of sanctions, the Russian government is kicking in $2.5 billion from something called the Well-Being Fund. And all of us should aspire to manage something called the Well-Being Fund. Can't imagine what Putin considers well-being, but it's probably a flexible definition. They think they're going to start up in 3 years. I don't think so. So just to get to the end, it's pricing, right? It's expensive to take gas. The liquefying Alaska natural gas is going to be the single most expensive component. The liquefaction charge is going to be more than the pipeline for 800 miles. It's going to be far more than the tanker run. It's going to be more than the value of the gas itself. It's a very expensive proposition. Like I say, up until this past year, you could get some very high prices for LNG in Asia. A lot of that was supply tightness after Fukushima, Japan's shut down nuclear. China demand was growing. Prices are half that. But, you know, again, that's today. It's more long term. Because of the unsettling market, buyers aren't quite sure where it's headed. You're seeing more buyers signing some short-term contracts. They don't want to quite lock in today for 20 years. A Korean company just signed a contract to buy gas from Chevron's project, Gorgon LNG, under development in Australia, and the Korean buyer signed a five-year deal. They'd like a little more certainty than just day-to-day pricing, but they're not quite sure the market has settled down for 20 years. Again, that helps to our advantage because we're not there yet. That unknown future pricing, it's tough on the project sponsors. They're trying to put together a $45 to $65 billion project. They don't know where things are going to be long term, but they do know that buyers like diversified portfolio. No country wants to be getting 100% of its gas from Russia or 100% of its gas from anybody. You know, they're going to go for, you won't have just one or two buyers for Alaska LNG. You have a dozen or more split up into little pieces, buying from Exxon, BP, Conoco, the state, diversifying the portfolio. It's going to come down to putting together a project that is price competitive in a changing world. So the last slide then is the prospects. The companies are online or on target to continue their field work in 2015, counting fish, measuring water, looking for wetlands, drilling boreholes, looking for soils, fault lines, things to avoid. The draft environmental reports turned into federal authorities will start the EIS process, start talking to communities to see what environmental, what socioeconomic, what traffic issues they want addressed. Hopefully they'll get the export license. I think the last one is going to be the key. The companies have said that the next step in this process would be to go to what's called FEED, front-end engineering and design, basically drawing the blueprints, getting your permits, putting everything together in 2016, 17, 18, so you're in a position in 2019 to make the investment decision. That front-end engineering design for the next 3 years would be $1 billion, $1.5 billion. They are not going to go there unless they feel they have, all the partners feel they have the fiscal stability and the predictability and a business plan that is going to work for the project that they can bring in on cost, on budget, at a competitive price. So politically, the governor, the legislature, and the partners are going to have to continue what they did last year and come up with some more specific terms on fiscal operations, or on commercial operations, on fiscal terms for the partnership with the state, and hopefully we'll get a decision then to go to engineering and design starting next year. With that, thank you.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Federal Coordinator of Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, Larry Persily, World Trade Center Anchorage Executive Director, Greg Wolf, and Northern Economics President and Senior Economist, Marcus Hartley. Their talk at the 2015 Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon, hosted by the World Trade Center Anchorage, was recorded at the Hilton Anchorage on January 27th. Greg Wolf of the World Trade Center Anchorage was next to speak.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Larry. You gave us a lot to think about, and we'll, like everyone, be monitoring the situation as you are. What I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about Alaska's international trade position and the role that exports play in driving our natural resource economy. And I thought start off with this slide. I roll it out every time we have a crisis. This is the Chinese symbol, the written language. For a crisis, but you can see it's made up of two parts, two characters. One of them represents danger, and the other one represents opportunity. So I think the point is here is the situation that we're facing now, and I've heard it described in several ways. I've heard it's a budget situation, it's a downturn, it's a bump in the road, or it's a crisis. But what we'd like to talk about today is the opportunity that exports present, in diversifying the economy and strengthening the economy and moving forward in a positive way. It's appropriate that we're talking about China because China has become the state's largest trading partner. I've been in this business 26 years, and for the first 23 years when I was doing presentations just like this, it was very easy. I didn't have to look at the slide. Japan was always the number one trading partner. That changed in 2011 when China became the number one trading partner, and in the subsequent years now, you can see the gap between number one and number two between Japan and China now is growing. China hasn't quite doubled our exports to Japan, but it's headed that direction. But you can see in our top three or four partners there, China, Japan, Korea, all major, you know, Asian markets for us. Our next door neighbor, Canada, another Pacific Rim market for us. And then you can see some of the smaller markets, important but smaller, are some of the European markets. And I think a distinguishing difference between our major Asian partners and our European partners is that the European partners tend to be a single commodity buyer. For example, you look at Belgium, number nine there. What in the heck do we export to Belgium? Well, it turns out it's like one thing. It's zinc and lead. So they're sort of a single commodity buyer. If you look at a country like Spain, it's almost 100% seafood. But if you look at China and Japan and Korea, they're buyers of almost everything that we sell. So usually everything that we sell, whether it's minerals, metals, forest products, seafood, energy, they're a buyer and sometimes a very large buyer of all of those. So it's the Asian markets that are really critical to us. If you look at a listing of the top, all of our markets worldwide, this just shows the top 10, you would see that Asia Pacific accounts for about 75% of all of our exports. Some of you may remember the late great Governor Wally Hickel, who was very fond of saying that while Alaska's political ties are with the United States, and thank God for that, Alaska's economic ties are with Asia. And he was right then, he's right now, and for the foreseeable future, he's absolutely spot on. So it's what's happening in Asia, particularly what's happening in China, is driving a lot of our export success. In 10 short years, our exports went from $100 million to $1.4 billion. This has never happened before in our state's history. This is the fastest growing market. No market has ever grown so fast to such an extent in our history. Our view on this is this. Currently, and for the foreseeable future, China will be our number one customer of our natural resource exports. Well, as the relationship evolves and grows, we see the next phase of this is China coming to Alaska as an investor, making investments with us, partnering with us in greenfield natural resource projects, expansions of current projects, but coming here as an investor. As we said before, we don't have any crystal ball or any inside information. All one has to do is look around the world to other natural resource jurisdictions like Alaska. Anywhere where there's an abundance of natural resources, who will you find? You'll find the Chinese there, probably the number one customer wherever you look. And if they're not there as an investor, they're probably on a plane from Beijing on their way to be an investor. Looking out ahead, the last couple years have been a slight decline. But we can see in the year that's just wrapping up, the final numbers aren't in, but 2014 will probably be a record year for our exports to China, again hitting about $1.5 billion. Looking at our exports overall, this hasn't really changed. I'm using 2013 numbers simply because 2014 is not available yet, but the percentages stay about the same. For as long as I've been doing this, seafood has been our largest export commodity. It's usually about 50%. You can see 2013, no exception. Minerals, in this case we're talking about zinc and lead, is our second largest category. The energy sector, of course, we don't export petroleum, but we have and do export LNG, Cook Inlet, for example, LNG to Japan. What's also in this category is coal that we've been exporting now for about 20 years, and then occasionally refined fuel products. Forest products, unfortunately, this is a category that's been in decline, not so much for lack of demand, but for lack of access. A lot of the supply is we can't log. And so it's not been a lack of demand, it's been a lack of access to the forest products for us to develop. Fish meal, of course, and then precious metals. This will be a growing sector as some of these new mines come on. We saw a new mine come on Kensington here recently in the past few years. So gold and silver will also be increasing as an export commodity. This is interesting because quietly, over the past 20 years. This is about a 20-year chart. Export levels from Alaska have actually doubled. We've gone from about 2.5 annually to now almost $5 billion annually. So quietly, this has been a growing part of the economy. There's only been two points in this 20-year history where it declined. The 1997-98, some of you may remember the Asian economic crisis, the Asian contagion, the Asian flu as it was described as. We took a hit, about $750 million, quickly recovered. And then the only other time it really declined was during the 2008-09 Great Recession. So other than that, exports have been a real success story, quietly growing for Alaska. It's been one of the most consistently growing parts of our economy. So we're asked, how do you account for this? How can your exports double? Well, what's driving this growth? So I've distilled it down to what I've dubbed the three rights. First of all, Alaska's in the right place. We talk a lot about our geographic location, for example, for the airport and being equidistant from Europe and Asia and North America, and that's all true, and it's the reason why we have one of the most successful cargo airports in the world. But it's also important to Alaska in the broader picture because it puts us, we are, of course, part of the Pacific Rim, and our neighbors, our next-door neighbors in the Pacific Rim, happen to be the fastest-growing economies and the fastest-growing populations in the world. If you're selling something, that's a great neighborhood to be in, and that's where we are. So we're at the right place. We're also at the right time. This is sort of interesting. The right time in history. The right time in history. I say that because we've seen over the past 20, 30 years economic liberalization in huge emerging markets like China, and India, elsewhere in Asia, and parts of Europe. These trends are opening up all sorts of private sector entrepreneurialism, economic growth that just wasn't there, and those economies, of course, are the fastest growing. And that economic growth has led to another historic trend, and that is the unprecedented migration of people from the countrysides of their countries into the city centers, into the urban centers. So people in rural China moving into the cities for a chance at a job at a factory, moving from a subsistence way of life to a working for a paycheck and becoming a consumer, really, joining a consumer class, really, for the first time, where they have money to spend and they have the same aspirations. They want what you've got. They want the latest this and the latest that. So we're seeing this happen. The economic liberalization, that's historic. The move of people, the migration from the rural to the urban communities. And I say it's historic because it's the first time in recorded history that the two countries with the largest populations, China and India, both over 1 billion people, are going through this migration at the same time. So this really is historic. McKinsey and Company has predicted by 2025, 10 years from now, 400 million Chinese will have moved from the countryside into the cities. 400 million, that's a big number. That exceeds the entire population of the United States. Can you imagine a move like that? India, same story. 200 to 250 million Indians will move from the countryside of their country into the urban centers. Again, this has never happened before. This is historic. Alaska is benefiting from this, and it's leading to the next right, the third right. And that is, we have the right stuff. We are selling the right commodities. What we have really, of course, we all know is world-class reserves of natural resources of all types. We have them here in abundance. But what we're selling isn't the latest Gucci watch or the latest iPhone or something like that. What we're selling, if you think about it, really are the building blocks of economic growth, economic progress. We are selling the building blocks. We're selling energy for power. We're selling metals for manufacturing. We're selling wood products for building and construction and those types. We're selling seafood for sustenance for growing populations. We are selling what growing economies have to have. So I like to think about what we're selling is not necessarily what people want. I mean, we all want the latest gadget. But we're selling what they need. We're selling the must-haves, and that's a critical point. These are things that they have to buy. And as long as we're competitive and we're reliable, we're going to be in these markets. So that speaks to a good future for us. So we're at the right place at the right time with the right commodities. And I'll argue there may be a fourth right. It's an emerging trend, future trend really for us, but that is the right direction. Alaska and the rest of the world are increasingly looking north. Well, that's really good news for us because this is our home, this is our backyard, and we are perfectly positioned to take advantage of these opportunities such as they are, and to have a voice in how change occurs, what developments occur. We have a voice and we have an opportunity to be involved in commercial development of the Arctic. This will give access to natural resources heretofore stranded, where we know where these, it's not just Alaska, it's around the Arctic, where there's resources, but you really couldn't get there. There was no infrastructure. You couldn't get it to market. You didn't have any power plants to power the mine or what have you. So access to natural resources will come online. There's going to be a huge, probably an unprecedented need for an economic infrastructure build-out. There's not much there in the region, and everything will have to be built from scratch. Again, that's tremendous opportunities for our companies in engineering and construction and environmental services, all of those types of things that our companies are very good at, particularly in the Arctic. Tremendous opportunities, maritime shipping opportunities, you name it. What's going to trigger this development? What's the trigger point that we build a $140 million dock somewhere? What has to be happening to justify that, to make it pencil out, to be economically feasible? So we're going to be talking about some of those subjects, about the trigger points for development in the Arctic. This is a sort of, we're talking about trade being big business, $5.2 billion, new money in the economy, thousands of direct and indirect jobs. We don't talk about the employment aspects of this too much, but we probably should. But the overall result is a stronger and more diversified economy. Exports and jobs. Our good friends at Northern Economics did a study just a couple years ago looking at how many people have a job tied to exports. They estimate about 15,000 Alaskans across the state have jobs tied directly to it, and about 10,000 in terms of indirect or induced jobs. What's important for this is a lot of these jobs are outside the urban centers. They're outside of Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, because that's where the resources are. They're not here. They're out. So in some parts of the state, this is the major source of employment now and into the future. These are good, high-paying jobs for rural Alaska. So these jobs are important for many reasons, but they're spread out all over the state, and many of them are where the resources are actually found. The U.S. Department of Commerce has also determined that export jobs tend to pay more than jobs tied solely to the domestic economy. They tend to pay 13 to 16% more. And if you look around Alaska, there's ample evidence of some of the higher paying jobs indeed are tied to exports. We get this question, how do we rank? $5 billion sounds like a lot of money. But how do we rank? Well, overall number ranks us 40th among all the states. That may not sound that great in and of itself, but when we look at exports as a percentage of our economy, the sort of gross state product, which I think you'll hear more about from Marcus here next, that's the sum of all goods and services produced in a state in a given year. Countries have a GDP and we have a GSP. So we rank 14th. In other words, for Alaska, exports are relatively more important than they are for, 36 of the other states. So it's as part of the economy, it's more important to us. And then when you go down to me and you on a per capita basis, Alaska ranks 4th. So that means it's more likely someone here living in Alaska that you, your neighbor, your relative has a job tied to trade in one way or the other. So it's very important to us for a lot of purposes. The other question that we get is, well, gosh, Greg, how many companies are actually exporting? And they've estimated now there's about 300 companies in Alaska that export. And I'm good with that number. But what's interesting about it is we also get asked is, well, Greg, I can understand how the big multinationals can do this exporting. My God, they got all the resources in the world. They got global staff, offices around the world. I can understand how they can do it. But is there really an opportunity for a small and medium-sized company? Well, the answer actually is yes. We know that because many of our members are such companies, small and medium-sized companies who are succeeding overseas. But even the Department of Commerce can verify that as well. They estimate out of these 300, about 75% are what they call SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. Now, that's a federal designation. It means 500 employees or fewer, which actually accounts for almost every company in Alaska. But nonetheless, small and medium-sized companies do have opportunities. So if I sound optimistic, and I believe I am, why? Why are you optimistic? Oh, well, to sort of wrap up, we have what the world needs. We have the fastest growing economies and populations in our own backyard. That's a good neighborhood to be in, isn't it? Commercial development of the Arctic presents some new opportunities for us looking forward. And many of our traditional industries that have been part of the history of Alaska, are really still relatively untapped. So I just picked one. Our good friends over at Commonwealth North do this asset review. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to look at it. I just pulled the page off that looks at mining, minerals and metals. And what they do sort of uniquely, sort of what the mayor was talking about they look at Alaska as a country. So sort of consider Alaska a country for a moment. And then compare Alaska to the rest of the world. Alaska versus Russia, Alaska versus Canada, Alaska versus Brazil. And then you look at the assets that we have. So take coal, for example. It's estimated we have 17% of the world's coal right here. That would rank us the second largest coal reserve in the world. Third most for copper, sixth most for lead, seventh most for gold. You go down the list, we're in the top 10 in all of these important, you know, industrial and strategic metals, and minerals and metals. But it raises also a question. Well, what are we doing about it? Take coal, all right, second most in the world, 17% of it is here. So you must think that we have a lot of coal mines going on, don't you? We must have a lot of coal mines. How many do we have that are operating? One. So I suggest to you this, that there's room for that one to grow, our good friends up at Usabelli, but also there's room for new entrants. There's coal across Alaska of various qualities. Some is closer to tidewater than others. There's tremendous opportunities in coal. And whether or not whatever you might feel about coal as an energy source, it's not going away. Coal is still king. And in some countries, they're building new coal plants every day. I think last time I looked, China's building 30 new coal-fired plants right now. So there's going to be markets for coal, whether it's here in Alaska or here in the United States. There's going to be global markets for coal. And I like the idea that they're burning our coal, because our coal tends to be lower in sulfur. It's a cleaner coal. And if they're going to be burning coal, I'd like them to be burning ours. Other opportunities, of course, we haven't exported a drop of North Slope natural gas. That would be our largest export project ever if we get that going. Rare earth elements, the state and the feds and private sector are looking around the state to inventory what we've got in rare earth elements. I've mentioned before that the name is an anomaly. They're not really rare. They could be some under this building right here, maybe in your backyard. But what's rare is to find them in quantities that make a mine, to make the investment of hundreds of millions of dollars in a mine worthwhile. To find them in quantity in one place, that's rare. And of course, service sector exports is a growing part where our companies in engineering and environmental services and construction are getting more and more contracts overseas. And then finally, this is something that's changed. I've been in this business 26 years. And during that period of time, most of the companies that are exporting today came to exporting late in somewhere maybe in the middle of their life cycle. I mean, they came to exporting more as an afterthought. I don't say that in a negative way. I mean, they were worried about the Anchorage market or the Alaska market, maybe the Pacific Northwest market. And then at some point they decided, wait a second, there's opportunities across the Pacific. How do I get into that? So maybe they were already 10 years old before they got into exporting. Maybe they were 20 years old. But now we're working with companies, startup companies, some are brand new, some are 4 or 5 years old, that from day one in their business plan, from day one, they have sales, overseas sales, as part of their business plan. For some, it's most of their sales will come from overseas. So we're seeing companies that are built to export. From day one, they are built to export. The local market is a less of a consideration for them. They're looking to where the customers are. And when they look across the Pacific, they can see a couple billion new customers. So that changes the dynamic. When you walk into the bank, we have some bankers here today, probably the typical loan application would talk about a potential universe of, you know, the population of Alaska, 700,000 potential customers if you sold a widget to every one of them. But if we start looking at the export model, and we can talk about a couple of billion other customers conceivable in the universe, it may make a lot of projects here and a lot of enterprises pencil out and be more feasible. So there's some opportunities for those who are looking outside of Alaska's borders. So closing with this, danger and opportunities. We all know what the dangers are of the fiscal situation we have now, but let's rise to the opportunity. Thank you.
The third speaker, Northern Economics President and Senior Economist Marcus Hartley, provided his economic forecast to close out the luncheon.
It really isn't time to panic. A lot of us kind of feel like we might be on the Titanic, but we're probably going to go into a recession in the next year. We may have already been into a recession, but it's not time to panic. We know what the icebergs are. We know where they are. We have our reserves. We just have to do more than rearrange the deck chairs. in 2005. It will be a challenge, we think, in 2015 will be a challenge. We think in 2016 it may be even more so. But we're not at 1988, at least not yet. It's not time to sell your house. Trading places, this slide gets into the way things are in Alaska and the way that we've kind of swapped places with the U.S. as a whole. The national and state economies have traded places. Basically, the national economy is in its best shape in years. But Alaska's economy is transitioning into a recession, we believe, with the oil price collapse. And the glide path of our transition is an important thing, and that's going to be determined by state spending, by oil industry spending, and along with the attitudes and input of the public on how we can address these issues. The U.S. economy here is creating lots of jobs. This is the best year we've had for employment since 1999. It's really good to see. Here's government spending, U.S. government spending as a percent of the economy, and then some forecasts, little dotted lines there. Pretty flat, but going along. Now we have the incomes, government incomes, revenues from taxes, and the forecast there. And that all leads to our national deficit. You can see here that the deficits are shrinking. They're very closely correlated with spending and income, as you can see here. And then we have the projected ones. So our national deficits are decreasing, and that's a good thing for all of the states, and Alaska in particular. On the downside, everything's not perfect in the U.S. economy. Our wages are very stagnant still. We're getting paid, but we're not getting paid any more than we have been in a long time. Well, let's look at Alaska in 2014. This is kind of our review of how we did last year in our forecast. Employment grew by 3%. We predicted much slower growth at 1%, so we were off. We had four sectors that lost jobs and four big sectors that gained jobs. Overall, the GSP fell by 4.6% to $56 billion. So how did we do? We projected these for our different sectors, and this is what actually occurred. There was a big change over construction and manufacturing. Mostly that's construction, and that was because of the very robust capital budgets that we had. We didn't do very well with health and education. One of the things that happened was that there were some private education jobs that were lost, and we missed on that. We note here that Alaska's employment growth has been slowing since 2011. This is in 2014, it was our fourth worst year in the last 17 years. So it wasn't a good year last year, and it's probably going to be a worse year coming up. Here's trends in year-over-year employment. This is the national trend. You can see where the big recession hit, and then the recovery. And here's Alaska's trend and our downward projection, which has really been happening for quite some time. Pretty cheery, I know. It's not. I'm trying not to be an optimist here. Well, here's the real story. So oil prices tanked. There we have oil prices from April through December, and you can see some pretty significant declines. But note that that was 2008. It was a little gotcha kind of a moment, maybe. But here's what they really look like in 2014. And I threw the 2008 numbers out there just to show you that, you know, we've been through some big price changes before. We've had a lot of ups and downs in oil prices. And this one here, over the last 8 or 10 months, is not as bad as we've seen before. So here's the long-term picture, and you can see the 2008 prices and the 2014 prices highlighted. Now, it wasn't, the other one wasn't because Obama was elected. We don't think it was because Sarah Palin was nominated. I mean, it could have been, because the timing is pretty good there. It's right there. But we don't think that. Really, there was a big speculation bubble going on in 2008, and it burst. And then we had the beginning of the financial crisis that took the whole country down, and frankly, most of the world. Right now, what we're seeing is a giant influx in global oil output, and that's driving prices down, and it will depend on how long that giant increase or influx of oil output continues until we see that price come back up. Well, from an Alaska perspective, these are the Department of Natural Revenue, ANS wellhead prices. The forecast are out there on the end for 15 and 16. And oil prices are falling, and the general fund is going to follow. And that's almost inevitable. This is the general fund state government spending adjusted for inflation. You can see that it's come down quite a bit in the last several years. Now, it's not just oil prices. We're really happy that we're not even going to show the oil production graph for the first time in 15 years of up here, but we know it's coming down as well. It's even more difficult to think about it in terms of per capita spending. Here we were spending $14,000 per person in Alaska. In 2015, we're looking at less than $4,000 per capita. So it's a big change and a little frightening, maybe. On the bright side, oil prices are down. We're much less dependent on oil. That's a good thing. We need to diversify our economy. Maybe not, okay. But, and what does come down can go back up. These are the price forecasts from the Department of Natural Resources for the coming year. So at some point, the prices will go up. Now, whether that happens in 2016 or 17 or 18 or 19 will really depend on the supply and demand issues on the global scale. Anyway, we're looking at a $3.4 billion deficit, and we can spend out of our savings, but if we keep spending $3.4 billion a year, we're going to run out of money in 7 years. Not all that cheery again. I'm really trying. Anyway, here's some of our assumptions for our 2015 forecast. Oil prices stay down, unfortunately. The fiscal year of 2015 budget is largely intact. And we're in 2015 right now, so it's kind of hard to change that. 2016 operations budgets will come down, but we think probably only in the single-digit percentages. The 2016 capital budget we're projecting will be pretty minimal. We think the oil industry will reduce costs, but not hugely. The net effect is that the first half of 15 will feel pretty normal, we're thinking. It's because we're already spending last year's money. We didn't have the price change until later. But the pain will really start to hit when we start getting into the next fiscal year around mid-year. We go through each of the sectors. We'll go through it real quickly. I know you guys are really interested in this, so I won't skip anybody. Natural resources, they're down 800 in jobs, 2.3%. Construction and manufacturing, down. Transportation and utilities, down. Government, well, down. But not everything is going to go down. This is my sector. I'm in the finance and other services sector. We're usually down. My wife's not happy about that either. Health and education, though, up. That's good. Trade, we think we're going to build some new stores. We're going to get some new jobs. That's up. Hospitality and leisure. The U.S. economy is good. That's going to bring the tourists up. They're going to be here. We're going to get some jobs out of that. Total change, we think we're going to lose 2,000 jobs next year. about a half a percentage decline. That's what it looks graphically, and those are all percentages and not really the scale in terms of the total number of jobs. Well, let's put our forecast into perspective. This is the total number of jobs in the Alaska economy, and you can see we've had a long increase, and our little forecast change in 2015 is just not that big of a deal. It is a recession. It is a down to it, or down a half a percentage. It's not the worst that we've ever had. In 86, the jobs were down 2.5%, or 2.1%, I'm sorry. And then in 99, we were down 0.3%. That, I think, was the Asia deal that Greg was talking about. So it's not a huge collapse, but it is a recession. Anyway, to wrap up, oil prices have fallen. We're only going to cover about 43% or 43 cents on the dollar for our revenue. The state has got significant reserves, so we're going to be able to pay for our government in the short run. Going to be a recession, but we have been tending toward that direction in over the last several years. The situation is serious. We don't want to downplay that. Is it time to panic? We still don't think so. We think that we have some time with our savings. We don't need to panic. Anyway, that's it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. I appreciate you all coming out.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Federal Coordinator of Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, Larry Persily, World Trade Center Anchorage Executive Director, Greg Wolf, and Northern Economics President and Senior Economist, Marcus Hartley. Their talk at the 2015 Statewide Economic Forecast Luncheon, hosted by the World Trade Center Anchorage, was recorded at the Hilton Anchorage on January 27th. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Evan Erickson.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.